So how's all that Soda Goat stuff been going? You've still been working with the app quite a bit recently, right? Sort of a resurgence?
Yeah, so it's actually really funny you ask that because I just pushed another update to it yesterday as we record. I added this feature. It's called the Summit Tracker. It's a brand new, like a top-level tab in the app. And what it is you point it at a summit and it gives you a little compass view. It tells you where to go to get to the summit, how far you are, and how much elevation you have to the summit. You know, how far you have to hike yet vertically.
Mm-hmm.
And some other details and stuff. And it was really fun to code up because the compass view is kind of cool. It basically mimics the iOS compass app where the labels kind of rotate around the compass but still stay upright. And the little compass arrow has some little 3D shadow effects that I kind of fake in there. So, and it works in light mode and dark mode and whatever. So that was actually really, really fun to work on, even though I haven't actually had a chance to leave the house and go freaking test it. But so I posted this update and I go on the Soda forum and I explain the update and features and stuff. Now, one of the things about Summits on the Air is that you have to be within the activation zone of the summit, which means that you have to be within 25 vertical meters of the peak of the summit, right? So 75 feet vertical. Doesn't matter. There's no horizontal radius. It's just vertical, you know, elevation. And I think the idea there is like, you know, you're still quote unquote on the summit top, but like maybe it's too steep and you can't reach the actual summit. You know, it gives you kind of a breadth of area to set up. Maybe you want to set up in the shade. Maybe you want to, you know, not be exposed to the wind or whatever. You know, it makes sense, right? They could have been a radius, but they did it as a vertical thing. Now, GPS gives you elevation data, but it's actually notoriously like inaccurate just by design. You can't get really good.
Really?
The accuracy of your vertical component is much, much lower than like your XY, your coordinate. And especially for cell phones and civilian applications, like I'm sure military applications are way, way better, right? So I posted this thing and then I just got this whole slew of like really, really pedantic people mentioning, well, the GPS accuracy isn't very good. This isn't going to be accurate. What if you have two summits that are nearby that are the same elevation? What if it's a really broad summit where you're like approaching it from many miles away and you're still within 25 meters? And I'm like, guys, use your common sense. This is a tool. Like, you know if you're on the peak or not. It's just the spirit of it that matters. It doesn't really matter that. It's like, I just thought it'd be a cool thing to add. And everyone's getting all pedantic about what it actually means to be within this imaginary circle. And I just gave up, man.
Really?
I started trying to justify, like, well, this, and then actually one of the guys emailed me directly and he's like, hey, I didn't want to stir the pot over on the forum.
Shame on you.
No. He was just saying all these other guys, man, it was really, really funny just to, I don't know, man, what some people are thinking.
They just take it quite like way, way too literally, too seriously.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. That's what it is. So I'm like, okay, well, if you don't like it, I'll just take the feature out. And they're like, whoa, hold on. That's the trick. You just gotta.
Well, I didn't say that.
Dangle the carrot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Other than that, I'm really happy to get that out. Got a couple little minor things I want to work on. And I also worked on the icons too. Designing icons is, I don't know, it's kind of fun, relaxing, and it's kind of nice to design your own little icon set that's somewhat cohesive.
You're becoming sort of the Renaissance technologist over there.
Hardly. I designed my icons in OmniGraffle. Okay, this is like working with cave paintings.
No, OmniGraffle is fine. It's doing so many different things over there. It's I don't know, it's cool to hear about because I do the same thing. It's like always web apps, always, just always.
But web apps are cool, man. And there's so many applications. I wish this could be a web app. If it didn't need all offline support, this would just be a really, really nice web app, you know?
yeah, I suppose that's true. Did you read the story about Apple making some changes to their policies around local storage in the name of privacy?
Yes, I did see that. So I think they're basically just wiping the local data after some interval of time, right?
I think it was 7 days, but yeah, essentially, yeah, the local storage gets wiped, which is you know, like a lot of PWAs or apps, like web apps that want to support offline, they store things in local storage. Obviously, session storage wipes itself sooner. Local storage is like, you know, a good spot for that. And I think I think even it wipes like index DB and everything too. So it's like a total cleaning of the house. So that sort of makes it, by default, it sort of makes, you know, PWAs or offline apps sort of untenable on iOS devices.
It's really, really too bad because they put in all this work to support all that stuff and got so close to making a really, really compelling experience, you know, being able to add an icon to your home screen and have it launch in a, you know, a borderless window. I mean, it seemed like they were going in that direction. I mean, from iOS 1.0, they were saying that web apps were the thing you should use. Before there was the App Store, there was only web apps on the phone, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's really baffling to me. Like, I get the concern with security. I mean, you could picture just normal websites using that to sort of go behind your back and store data, much in the way that these cookies or whatever. But
yeah.
I could also picture a world where there's an API, a WebKit dot, you know, request local storage or request offline app, and you call into Safari, and Safari says, "Hey, this website wants to store data long-term on your device. Is that okay?" And you hit yes, and it saves it, and it puts an icon on your home screen, right? And as long as you have that icon on your home screen, you should have local storage. And if you delete it, then it should delete it. I don't, like, make it opt-in. And that way, you know, people who don't want to have a need to write a native iOS app can still provide that really good experience. I mean, I think that would be awesome, but Yeah, really baffling to me.
Yeah, it is interesting. Even the idea of prompting, I mean, because that's similar to, you know, hey, this website wants to know your location, or hey, this website wants to send you notifications, right? I think it was even Firefox that recently just declines those by default now, or doesn't even show them. You actually have to click into the little, because normally there's like that little pop-up in your browser, and then there's, I don't remember what the icon is, but you click the button and then you can re-enable it later. I'm pretty sure that it was Firefox that now just by default blocks those notifications, and you have to like manually go into the settings and opt into notifications or location stuff for each particular website.
Yeah, you think browser designers would learn that if you give web developers access to data about the user, they're going to ask for it, whether they deserve it or not. And it's going to be annoying, and right, people are just going to click OK without reading or thinking about it, and you're just back where you started. Like, this is the web from the beginning.
You're just Googling for any sort of news story, and every time you land on a news website, hey, let us send you notifications. It's like every single one. So what could have been, you know?
There should be three buttons. There should be yes, no, and close this tab forever. Never come back to this website. That should be the third button.
Yeah. Yeah, auto add entry to hosts to send you back to localhost or whatever. Hijack the request. Yeah, that's unfortunate. Really unfortunate. I mean, we even at Design Collective early on, we had a lot of discussions around this because, you know, we wanted to facilitate local shopping, which means that we need to know where a person's located so we can show them what's close to them. And so there were a lot of discussions. I guess it was difficult to explain to the non-technical people on the team, like, if we pop open that, hey, can we have your location, and someone clicks no, it's really hard to get back from that because the person has to go into their browser settings and re-enable it. And a lot of people, yeah.
We have this exact same issue on Roadham Radio with WebRTC. It's the same thing. It asks permission for your microphone. And if you weren't paying attention or you hit close or, yeah, then it's easier now. They make it, you know, it's pretty much one or two clicks away.
It is, yeah, and we were trying to say like how difficult it is to come back from that. You know, like people, especially if they're just shopping for furniture and they come back and they're like, "Why wasn't I? I can't find anything close to me." It's like, "Well, you did you dismiss this thing?" Yeah, okay. Well, we have to go over here. Well, I'm not doing that. People, I don't know. That's what I found or experienced anywhere. People being really short or didn't understand why our site was broken. Basically, is how they would describe it to me. So yeah, I mean, we just started suppressing that notification and we just show a couple of banners here or there instead. So, oh, by the way, if you want to put a zip code in here instead of us like auto getting your location, Or putting a little banner saying, hey, if you want more accurate results, you can click this, and then that triggers the little request for the permission.
Can you tell from JavaScript if they had already denied it?
I'm trying to remember now. I think you get, yeah, you get some sort of error back. It's been quite a while since I looked at any of that stuff, but I'm pretty sure you get some sort of error back.
Yeah, it's kind of a similar thing on iOS. Again, going back to SodaGoat was location stuff. You know, I pretty much assume that if you've purchased this app and you launch it, you can trust me enough to accept location services to be on, but you still have to handle a case where they hit no. And it's a real pain in the butt to have to do both cases, because you want to design all these cool features that are centered around, hey, I know where your location is, either roughly I know your location is, or exactly I know where your location is. So for example, like on the, when you're going through this summit picker, like a browser screen, which you have to do a lot to sort of, you know, find nearby summit or find whatever summits, I added a list there of, hey, here's the top five summits that are closest to you. Because most of the time, that's what you're going to be tapping on anyways, why make you dig through the menus to find it.
Right.
But in order to do that, you have to have location services on. And, you know, I need to be able to just grab your location when the view loads. And then I just turn off location services once I get the location. But I'm like, well, that's cool. And the first time you launch it, you can tap it to request location services. But other than that, like, what do? I just hide it. And just like, I don't even bother showing an error or anything. I'm just like, you know what? You hit no. Screw you. I'm not even going to show you that table view. Like, you're done. No more for you.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the trust thing, I have some family members, I know some people that they could be paying for a service. And so I know someone that has a VPN and they pay for this VPN. And occasionally when the VPN has an update, it'll ask for you to put your password in so it can update itself, because VPNs are doing some more low-level things on your machine. Well, this person doesn't know what that means. They inherently don't trust it, so they don't update their stuff, and then their stuff breaks. Like, VPN won't connect, the website, they can't get on the internet because they have auto-connect turned on, so it just keeps failing to connect. So I go and look at the machine, and they're like, why is this broken? I was like, okay, well, it looks like there's an update that has to be applied. And they're like, oh, yeah, I saw that, but I didn't know what it meant, so I just click cancel. And left it like that. So, you know, people, like the developers, like the application just marches forward, and you know, I'm sure that's like an extreme edge case for them, you know, to have someone decline an update because they didn't, you know, understand what the dialogue meant or trust them that what the dialogue meant is what it actually was going to do, you know, which causes basically a complete system failure at that point, right? Because they can't get onto the internet. But It's always difficult, right? Like, I made the thing, you bought it from me, so you should probably just trust that I'm not going to sell you out sort of situation. But
yeah, I mean, I don't even store email addresses, you know? I don't want any of that PII in my DB. So it's interesting because Chrome has a system in place where it knows if the user took an action. Was it Chrome or Safari? I don't remember. Maybe both. But basically, like, if you want to autoplay sound, I think is where I ran into this. It won't do it unless the operation that triggered that sound was user initiated.
Hmm.
I think it was actually specifically had to do with creating an audio context, which is a web audio thing that allows you. It's basically an audio graph that allows you to actually do web audio stuff. It's kind of like your workspace where you add all your nodes and do stuff.
Okay.
But in order to create the audio context, you can't do it in the background, like on page load or whatever. You have to wait for for the user to click on something before you can instantiate it. So I have some function or method that's just like ensure audio context exists or something. And I call it on every single possible button click that you could do to cause you to need that before it like initializes.
Huh.
Kind of annoying. I understand where they're coming from. And at the same time, I feel like you could use that same mechanism for things like location services, for things like local storage, you know, PWA kind of permissions things. It's not perfect, but it's another tool that they have to implement it to try to combat some of these things.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like, I'm not trying to blame anything on the media really, but it's like there's so many stories of security issues and hacking and so company violating your privacy rights and like Zoom recently has been in the news quite a bit, right? Their adoption's been going through the roof because people are at home. You know, schools are even using Zoom for their classrooms. Like, I think my niece had a classroom wide day on Zoom recently, and you have all these stories coming out because of Zoom's newfound, like, you know, increase in users. Like, these stories are coming out like, oh, they have this problem, they have that problem, they're betraying you here, they're betraying you there. So I feel like most people aren't going to go and look at stories about technology, I don't think, unless they're into technology. Most people will just hear the negative stories that proliferate into the mainstream media, like Zoom is spying on you, or Zoom can turn your camera on without you even knowing it, and Zoom puts a web server on your computer, it's always running and talking to them, right? Like, people hear stories about that, and so that's what they remember about technology, is all these companies are inherently just trying to steal your data. I mean, maybe they're right, but they sort of apply that thinking to every company, no matter how small or innocent.
I remember the Zoom stuff that came out months ago. I think it was on the Mac specifically, like they're running web servers and stuff like you mentioned. And I don't know if anything ever changed because of that, because maybe they weren't big enough for them to, you know, make that change. And obviously they're just still doing the same old crap.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just now on a way bigger stage.
There's more. Yeah. There's even more. So I've been seeing, even more just stories. Like I just Googled one, and there's one for 4 minutes ago or 4 hours ago. Something about Zoom's password and hijacking. it's just not good. Like, you type in Zoom and you instantly see war dialing tool exposes Zoom password problems, Zoom issues fixed for UNC vulnerability that attackers steal Windows credentials, Zoom is leaking your sensitive data to strangers, Zoom could be stealing your Windows password. Like, not a single good story up in here. And you have to think, like, all these people, they're now newly working from home, and their company's like, oh, we have to start having our meetings on Zoom. And so someone types Zoom into the browser, and this is all they're going to see, is maybe rightfully so, because Zoom's not, doesn't seem to be doing a great job. But this is the first thing they see, is your passwords are gone, your personal data is gone, they're spying on you all the time, sort of stuff.
Yeah, I'm under the impression that most of the time, even negative publicity is still publicity. But man, it's really hard to come back from stuff like that. I'm really curious to see how this pans out. I know I was talking with some family members, you know, who have kids. They're working from home. Their kids are taking class lessons, you know, being taught from home. And he's like, I've never heard of Zoom ever before in my life. And now my whole life is on Zoom.
Yeah, that's sounds really pretty similar to some other people I know as well. It's real interesting. You see all the stories, you know, about the virtual backgrounds going around. You see all the stories about, like, spouses walking through the background naked or something like that when someone, like, they're on a call.
The thing is, there's so many better tools, though. I mean, last weekend, are you familiar with the Jackbox Party Pack, those games?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, they're so much fun, but normally you play them on TV, where the game is played cooperatively on the TV, or so, like, the game is on there, you join on your phone using a web browser, using like a code, and then you play, your phone is like the controller for the game, which is cool. So what I did was I basically, on Discord, I got a bunch of my friends in there, shared my screen, and did audio hijack and routed all the audio so they could hear the game. And then we all played Jackbox games if we were in the living room together, but it was just over Discord. It was actually really, really fun.
That's pretty cool.
But like, Slack has video calls and screen sharing. Skype has obviously been around forever, but I don't know if I would never recommend Skype, obviously.
Right.
You know, Discord. Like, all these things already exist. I don't know how this happened.
Well, if you go to Product Hunt too, there's like a handful of new work from home companies starting every day, including video conferencing softwares. There was one that did look interesting. I don't recall the name. I might be able to look it up really quickly. But it seems like, yeah, there's just a huge proliferation of companies that are focusing on this issue and trying to cash in on the new, like, scores of people that are now working from home and trying to figure it out.
Yeah. I was initially under the impression when this whole thing started that a lot of people are basically never going to go back to work. Like their mm-hmm. jobs are just going to stay remote because they can, and people are going to realize that's okay. But more and more I'm realizing that, and I think I mentioned this briefly last week, that people really, it's not always a good fit, whether it's the job or the people themselves. It's definitely not a silver bullet that I kind of thought it would be for so many types of jobs that I had anticipated.
It's been interesting to watch people sort of adjust to it and give their feedback on it. And I guess it's not necessarily a peer experiment, right? Because people aren't just now newly working from home. There are a lot of people that are now newly working from home. Their kids are home too. They, you know, they have way more distractions than maybe they would normally have. And a lot more on their mind too, right? A lot of stuff to think about, family and friends. Maybe people aren't healthy. Maybe people have lost their jobs. So it's sort of like sort of a worst case scenario for people to learn how to work from home, because the first few months are really difficult. You have to learn how to keep your focus by yourself. You don't, you know, there's not like a water cooler to walk to and back. There's not coworkers to sort of help make you feel productive if they're being productive. You're just by yourself in many cases, and that's difficult to deal with, especially, you know, you get in day 3, day 4 and you're like, I'm losing my mind in here, right? So I can only imagine how difficult it can be if you compound it with all the other social issues that are happening. I feel like, I mean, I've been struggling a little bit too, just to focus for various reasons, but I have the benefit of having 5 or 6 years under my belt now. So I know what I need to do to trigger or reset myself to be able to focus again. But that takes a while for people to sort of learn that about themselves.
Yeah, I think you summed it up perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, like, you know, I think Discord's been great for us because I'll just hop into a voice channel and someone else will almost always just jump in and be like, hey, what's up? And that's been really helpful. And I have seen people across Twitter just throwing out Zoom links or Google Hangout links. You'd be like, hey, I'm hanging here for a while. If anyone's lonely, just hop in for a minute, you know? So I think that's been kind of cool. It's been kind of cool to see things like that happening. But I can only imagine how the struggle is for people that are probably worried about losing their jobs and trying to just to focus to keep work going, keep the business going. And, you know, I have a dog, like, dropping spitty toys in my lap, but that's different than having a child, you know, pulling for my attention. So, yeah, I guess I need to send some positive vibes out into the world. Maybe help some people out if they're struggling with that.
Put those vibes in the show notes.
Yeah. You can download them from dnc.show. So how did that contest go? I think last week you were talking about having some sort of soda goat contest.
Oh yeah. So this is actually a really good pivot here, because we're talking about social distancing and everything. We had a really unique opportunity this past weekend to experiment in the world of ham radio and do something in a way that had never been done like this before. I mean, literally unprecedented. So this is going to, it's going to require a little more explanation. I think you're mentally primed for this because I sort of explained how Summits on the Air works, and hams like to gamify the hobby, right?
Sure.
One of these big aspects of ham radio is called contesting. They call it radio sport. It's the sport of ham radio. It's a competitive way of operating that lets you sort of pit head to head against people all over the world and compete, and they kind of on the same playing ground. And the way these contests work are they're sponsored by different groups in the hobby, whether the magazines or the ARRL, which is, you know, like the U.S.'s sort of organization of ham radio operators. There's international ones as well. And the way this contest works are there are periods of time, usually 24 hours, 48 hours. Sometimes they're short ones, like 4 hours. Sometimes they're, you know, longer. And there's a set of rules, and basically you sit down, you try to make as many contacts with as many people as you can within this time period, and depending on the rules for the contest, you get points. The points might be based off of location, that might be based off of the person's call sign, that might be based off of some other crazy metric.
Okay.
but you're just trying to accumulate as many points as possible. And when you make a contact, you're really just exchanging your call sign with the person, maybe a small piece of information like a number or some kind of code, and then you say goodbye and you work the next guy. And these, you're just ripping, ripping, ripping through these contacts. You can make, on voice, you can make upwards of 120 contacts an hour, right? Every 30 seconds, boom, 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 boom. And it can get really, really intense. You can imagine going for 48 hours straight.
Yeah.
With nothing but static and people talking all over you, because everyone's doing this, so they're all jammed in side by side on the frequencies. So they're just like, it's this constant barrage of to your senses. But it's really, really fun. I know it's not really selling it, but it's cool to sort of be a part of that experience. The contest this weekend was unique because normally a bunch of people get together in a station and operate. Some of these stations have multiple radios, 3, 4, 5, 6 radio positions, all connected to different antennas, all operating simultaneously. Well, guess what? You can't do that when you're isolating in place. It just doesn't work.
Right.
We are uniquely set up to take advantage of that because everything we do is remote. Everything's remotely controlled. You don't need to physically be there. That's, you know, it's right in the name. So we attempted to do something that had never been done before. In that, now people have done contesting remotely, but not quite like this. And so we had this inkling of an idea. This was 1 week prior to the start of the contest. It was a Friday beforehand, the Friday before the Friday. Lee floats this idea by me. And we had a couple technical challenges to overcome. We had 3 stations that we wanted to operate simultaneously. We had 10 people on our team who were going to operate them in shifts. And we just used Google spreadsheets to sort of schedule everyone, you know, within the whole 48-hour period. People are like getting up at 2 a.m. and stuff to operate.
Right.
We needed a logger. So we needed a way to log all of our contacts together in one single logbook. You know, as you're making the contacts, they all need to be collated in one big file that you can send up to them so they can check your score.
Mm-hmm.
We needed a single user account to be able to log into multiple stations at once. That was something we'd never done before. Normally it's one-to-one. And the logger needed all its functionality. It needs to be able to know your score. It needed to be able to detect duplicates. If you already worked a call sign, like you don't want to work them again because it's 0 points. It's a waste of time. You needed to be able to have fuzzy matching for the call signs. It's called super check partial. Basically, like if I type in 3 letters, it should be able to tell me, oh, you probably meant this call sign, because sometimes it's really hard to hear.
Oh, okay.
So if I type ABC, it should recommend like W3ABC. We have a database of 32,000 call signs that we just check against. All this crazy stuff needed to be done, and my head was swimming. Like, how am I going to do this? And again, going back to thinking about client-server API, where's the data stored? How do I do the lookup? How do I make it fast, right? Because it needs to be as you type. This stuff has to be really, really fast. It was really, really daunting to think about all these different things. You know what ended up just being the simplest solution? 100%. Was done in Vue.js. Almost none of the logic was done server side. Like that, I barely even touched that.
Mm-hmm.
I just decided, you know what, this is a client concern. This is all like Vue logic, V-I-E-W logic. There's no reason to have to phone home to server to do this one particular special use case that's technically like a throwaway. It's a special case. Like every single contest that you're going to operate is going to have a totally different set of rules for scores, for points, for multipliers, for duplicates.
Mm-hmm.
Why try to spend all this effort building a system that like can accommodate every single possible contest rule set when I can just write a Vue component, throw all the logic into there and methods and computed properties and be done?
So at that point your backend is just like purely a data store.
That's right. And then if it comes time to code up the interface for another contest, I just make a new component and I just start from scratch again because it's going to be totally different. There's almost like, you know, I can reuse some components, but for the most part, all that stuff, it just lives in the browser.
Mm-hmm.
And man, that once I kind of hit on that idea that this doesn't need to be a whole thing, this just needs to be, it just needs to be good enough. It's got to be fast. It's got to be easy to change and manipulate. Man, it worked really, really well. Having all that logic sort of tied up in the component, it's it's kind of limiting. It's hard to get stuff in and out of there if you want to start implementing other more complicated features. But for getting this out the door with literally a week before the contest started, starting with nothing, was it made it possible. And you know, it's obviously messy. Working with a deadline is really hard like that. You have to make a lot of concessions and to-dos, and you know, I just didn't encapsulate things the way they should have been, right? Just kind of throw it all on the page and get it out there.
Mm-hmm.
But man, it freaking worked flawlessly. I was just, it was really, really something.
That's really cool. A week from start to finish, you said?
Yep. Friday to Friday. And I worked out a little on the weekend.
So I assume the event went fine? No issues or anything like that?
Well, yeah, you would think that. Something wrong with the contest, whether you're in person or not.
Sure.
Yeah, so I coded up some of the backend stuff to be a little naive. Basically, every time that you logged a contact, the way I had it sync the state of the component backup was it would just re-download the entire logbook, like from every single contact. Obviously, that does not scale. I just didn't really know how far I could take it.
Yeah.
After we got about 12 hours in, I started to see the CPU climb on the server. We started the contest at 8 p.m. local time. I went to bed. I woke up in the morning on Saturday. Oh shoot, this is not gonna last us to the end of the contest. So 48 hours, the servers will melt. Yeah, again, it was a naive implementation. I knew better, but I just didn't want to spend the time. If I didn't have to, turns out I had to spend the time. So basically I just changed it so it would only push the diffs to the client. So I just pushed the new contacts out, which is obviously way smaller.
Right.
But the problem was that we're operating this contest. I don't want to interrupt the operators because in order to push the code, I don't want to have to cause them to refresh or restart or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In comes hot code reloading to save the day once again.
That little old thing?
Yeah. It's a crutch I lean on way more than I should, but man, it's great. I actually did mess it up once. I botched one of the deploys and it wouldn't take the new code. So I had to manually set version numbers on the modules and then roll the version number a couple times to get it to force those modules to reload.
Oh, right.
It was really hairy. It was like half deployed. That was not good.
Yeah, it said in their cold tweet, like, come on, come on, come on.
Yeah, don't die, yeah. Don't die. But I'll put a link in the show notes to the Grafana CPU usage. It's pretty obvious when I did the deploy because the CPU drops right down and then it stays down. Thank God. I mean, by the end of the contest, we were at about 7,600 contacts in the logbook.
It's a big payload.
Yeah, exactly. The database had no problem. Database barely even put up a sweat.
Yeah,
but rendering all the JSON was really where it started to bog down, and transferring the data. I mean, it started to get into the megs. Anyway, when all is said and done, 40 hours later, I'm trying not to bury the lead here, but basically we have a new high score. We set a world record or USA record for this contest, highest score of all time doing this, which was crazy because it was just, again, it had never been done this way before. We were 100% remote. We had two 17-year-olds, a 13-year-old and a 21-year-old on our team operating alongside us, and then the guys who are super experienced, older than me, 32 million plus points. I mean, we blew away the previous record. We'll see if that stands when they actually check the logs, but we really, really ruffled some feathers with this, and we're going to be on the cover of CQ Magazine now. And
that's awesome.
All these like people are getting nervous. They're starting to see that this is the future that they've been pushing back against. And they're shaking in their boots, and it's just so great. It's just so great to see all the old men.
What is this technology? We're hams.
Yeah, come to terms with this thing that exists now and is going to be basically the future of how we do things. I mean, we are never going to operate a contest the same way ever again. We're just going to keep doing this. Why not?
Yeah.
Why am I going to go sleep in a bunk bed and sit next to some smelly guy who hasn't showered in 2 days using a dirty microphone that smells like someone else's bad breath?
Yeah.
No thanks.
Yeah, microphones can get pretty smelly.
Oh, God. Yeah, I'm sure you know.
They're disgusting.
Ugh.
Yeah, especially if you're not at the level where you can bring your own, or like if you don't have one. It's not like you have to be at a big level to do that. You just buy one. But especially if you have, like, you go into the bar and you have to use, like, the house mic or whatever. Who knows how old that thing is?
So gross. You can just see the food particles in there?
Yeah, They're usually rusted, right? Because they all have the little grill on top. They're usually pretty rusty. Sometimes, like, I was always told when you're, like, public speaking, too, if you have a mic, just kind of rest it on the bottom of your chin. But that doesn't work great when there's hair on your chin, because then your hair gets pinched in and you start pulling hair out of your chin on the mic and it hurts.
That's how you get coronavirus, Sean.
That's what I've heard. But speaking of the cold sweats we mentioned earlier, half deploys, and just like saying, please deploy, please deploy. I came across this story earlier and I got a kick out of reading some of the messages on the thread, but I saw a story on Reddit that was titled Square Enix published an update for Final Fantasy IX on PC that deleted the entire game.
Oh no. That's not an April Fool's joke, is it?
Uh-uh. Nope. Someone pushed a patch and it wiped out a bunch of stuff on the server.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And then, so then like scrolling through the threads, there are people talking about when they were younger, how they're playing on like the PlayStation 1 and you had discs. Sometimes games would come out and they'd be like multiple disc sets. And so you get to a point in the game and you have to put a new disc in. Like, oh, you have to put disc 3 in now. And apparently one of the Final Fantasy versions was notorious for having disc 4 just not work very well for most people. So you'd get to like the last part of the game, try to switch to disc 4 and it would just crash or not work. And some people reported that it worked for them if they held their PS1 upside down after putting the disc in.
The bad old days, man.
Yeah, and that led me to another story. Apparently, EVE Online, I've never played it, but I've heard about it. EVE Online, apparently in 2007, I guess they released an update, like a premium update that people had to pay for. And the update actually wiped out the boot.ini file on Windows, and so it like bricked a bunch of people's PCs.
Oh yeah, I was reading that. Put that link in the show notes, because...
All right.
The developer was like, how is this even possible?
Yeah. Apparently, the packaging tool they are using to build the downloads didn't really have a great compression algorithm. And so they found one that compressed things quite a bit. I think they got the payload. And this is, 2007. So the internet speeds weren't like, they weren't dial-up, but they weren't amazing. So they found a tool that the compression algorithm was way better. It got the payload from like 800 or 900 megabytes down to like 500 or something. So it turns out that this new compression tool, I guess some documentation was wrong or ambiguous. And so at some point way back in EVE's history, whoever was building the boot sequence for the game called that file boot.ini, which is the same file name as the Windows system uses. So fast forward, they're using this new tool for the installer and compression and stuff, and they misconfigured something. And so instead of wiping the relative path to boot.ini, it wiped the root path boot.ini, which means that the Windows computers could no longer boot up. And I think they said they fielded something like 215 customers calling in about their computers no longer working.
That's like, yeah, that's the bane of all shell scripting there is, what's the path?
It's pretty rough. And I believe it even said that in some cases they had to pay for Geek Squad or some technician to go out and fix these people's PCs. We have it pretty good. I've never had to worry about breaking someone's OS installation.
Dude, Jess brought home one of her coworkers' computers to help me try to see if we could get back into it because she lost her password. Long story short, we got her reset her live.com address and we got back into it. It was fine. I'm like, well, while I'm here, while we've got the computer, let me just run some Windows updates for her and clean it up and make sure it's okay before we send it back. You know, just do something nice. Try to run the Windows 10 upgrade. You don't have enough space on this disk to run the update. I'm like, okay, I'll go clean out the downloads, clean out the recycle bin, run disk cleanup utility. Did all that. Didn't free up really any space. Empty recycle bin, empty downloads. I'm like, still not enough space. Go to my computer. is a 32 gig solid state drive, of which there were 2 gigs free, and Windows was like half of that. And also compression was turned on by for all these folders. So even then it was still running out of space. I don't know who turned on compression. Normally you have to do that manually. Maybe Windows decided to be like, hey, I'm just going to start compressing things.
Yeah.
Have you ever turned on compression on Windows folders?
No.
You can do it. It's been built in Windows forever. It makes everything slow to a crawl because it's decrypting or decompressing things in software and using memory to do that, obviously.
Sure.
And this is a 1.6 gigahertz Celeron. It's like this purple plastic HP thing with like a... might as well have been a monochrome screen, dude. I'm like, this is why people hate computers. Like, you spent probably $15 for this on Best Buy sale and like then complain about it. Man, 32 gigs! Literally half of it was Windows, and there was nothing on it. There was no data, there were no photos, there was no music, there was no documents, there was nothing, and it had no space free.
That's wild.
Drive me crazy, man.
On a similar note, Jaggi had just recently taken over the Alder and Tweed stuff. They haven't really had a dedicated developer for a long time, and Alder and Tweed furniture site runs on WooCommerce actually. And so Jaggi was trying to get stuff moved over and backed up so that way he could work on things without having to work in production. And he was having just the hardest time getting things moved over and downloaded because I forget how many gigabytes the payload was, but it was pretty large, especially for, I mean, they have, it's a big site, a lot of furniture, but it was especially large payload size. So anyway, after about a week of him just sort of trying to get things worked out there, he finally messaged me one day. He's like, I figured it out. And he said that there was some sort of WordPress plugin installed that was making backups, and it was somehow configured to also, in the backups that it would take, it would also include the backups directory. So we had a recursive backup situation happening for who knows how long.
I'll admit, I've never seen that. That's awesome.
Yeah, it blew his mind when he was, like, I didn't, you know, I've never really done anything with their site at all. I've never signed into the WordPress stuff at all or clean anything. So he was just struggling all week. He's like, I just can't get this thing to download, man. It's like, you know, he lives in the Philippines and he has a pretty good connection, but it just wasn't cooperating. And it's sort of one of those things where it's like WordPress is running on a shared server somewhere and he's having all sorts of trouble. And so then he finally figures out that there's, you know, the backups have been backing up the backups for who knows how long. So yeah, deleting that kind of made it a lot easier for him to fix that up. But it was sort of one of those things where you would never think about that. You look at the backup plugin, you're like, oh, cool, things are getting backed up, you know. But you never think to look at the configuration. Like, is it backing up the backup dir too?
That's amazing.
Yep. Luckily, I haven't had to deal with anything that mind-numbing for a while.
I was working with someone recently who had a Git repository under a shared iCloud folder.
Oh no.
That did not end well. As soon as you start switching branches and files start appearing and disappearing, iCloud starts freaking out and making like .2 versions of everything.
Mm-hmm.
No good.
Same thing if you try to run a logic project off of an iCloud folder, it'll crash.
Good to know. I will avoid that.
Yeah, it'll crash. Semi often, especially if you try to like undo a recording or like delete a region or something like that, Logic will just crash on you.
I feel like we could go on for hours with these stories.
Yeah. I'm starting to run out of things to think about. But yeah, I'll put the link to those threads in the show notes because they're full of interesting, nostalgic, for me anyway, things. And you're right, the EVE Online write-up about that was really interesting because the person introduced himself. He's like, I'm Dr. So-and-so, and I'm like the head of software at EVE Online, and we break people's computers. How could this possibly happen? And that was like the intro to the blog post. I got a kick out of it today.
I like these write-ups that are technical enough that you can understand the problem. Even the layperson, you know, gamers, you might not be a developer or know how games work. And then there's all these questions at the bottom. There are a few observations that you could rightly make. Why do you have a file the same name as a Windows startup system file? Why doesn't Windows protect its system startup files? Why was this caught in a code review? Why didn't you catch this during testing? Like, all these things that...
Yeah.
It's a perfect storm, right? All these things had to go wrong for this bug to happen.
Well, and the game industry is specifically notorious for overworking, like, crunch time, right? They call it crunch, you know? Just going into crunch time, and deadlines seem to never be hit in the game development for a myriad of reasons, and there's always crunch time. You would think that budgets or time budgets would change, but they never do. And so, yeah, the person in this specific article, the person was like, well, how did this happen? He said, legacy. And then he explained that that file had been with the company for 6 years. So it was always that way, he said. So we never changed it. And so that's why it happened. It's legacy. It wasn't my fault, basically. And then, they talked a little bit about, like, working long hours and, you know, working overnights trying to get the update out the door and all that stuff, which, yeah, fatigue is going to play a big part in that, you know. It's just like the same old answers to the same old questions when it comes to, like, how did this catastrophic technological event happen? How did GitLab dump their production DB? How did, there was another company that did it not too long after GitLab did it too, but I don't recall who it was. Anyway, yeah, but yeah, it's all the same stuff. Just like being in a hurry, being distracted. Yeah, but maybe we can take that as a lesson, like, don't ship during the coronavirus outbreak. We're all distracted. Don't delete your database on accident.
Yeah, especially don't get distracted by a wet chew toy in your lap.
So gross. He does it on purpose, I feel like, now.
You should assert your dominance and start chewing on the toy back.
So gross. No, I won't do that. We can't go to the dog park because the dog parks here are closed now, so he doesn't get to play with other dogs, and he's taking that energy out on me instead. But that's okay. We just go for longer walks now.
I was going to say, take him for a hike this weekend. You can take Soda Goat, find a summit.
I don't think technically in where we're at, you're not supposed to leave. You're not even supposed to, like, go to different neighborhoods and stuff.
Yeah, that's probably for the best.
Yeah, I think it was like a week ago. I was at the dog park just by myself. Just me and Watson by myself. And I've been really careful. Like, I wear a glove when I go outside and touch the gate and do this stuff. And we're just standing there. And this kid comes up to the fence. He's like, hey, excuse me. I don't want to be rude, but did you know the park is closed? And I was like, yeah. He's like, there's a sign over there. And I was like, okay. And he just turned around and ran away. And then I saw him, like, he went into another neighborhood, and I was like, hey, you're not supposed to be over here. You're not even from this neighborhood.
Did you really?
No, I didn't. I didn't say that, but yeah. I don't know. It's interesting because, you know, supposed to be... Like, we walk around the park now, like, we'll on the sidewalks and stuff, but there's people still, like, playing soccer, sitting at picnic tables, laying in the grass, doing all the stuff they're not supposed to be doing. It's hard, I get it, but such is the world today. Not really sure how to bring this plane down.
Safely, please, with the landing gear down.
Slowly, yeah. Yeah. Well, if anyone has any interesting stories to share about holding their PlayStation upside down when they're younger, please let us know. I'd love to hear about that.
Oh man, I destroyed one of my Halo discs accidentally. Moved the thing while it was spinning. Heard a grinding noise. Laser dug a perfect circular ring right in the bottom of that disc. I never even got to play it.
I had a CD player for a while and I tripped once and it did the same thing. It just chewed up whatever CD I was listening to. Bummed me out.
Mm-hmm.
You hear that noise and you're like, no.
They should have that thing like MacBooks. I don't know if they still have it. Well, no, obviously they don't still have it. They don't have spinning drives. MacBook hard drives used to use the accelerometer.
Mm-hmm.
And if they detected that the MacBook was in free fall, you know, zero Gs, it would stop the hard drive and park the heads.
That's cool.
So it's important to prevent damage.
That's pretty cool, because I remember seeing people walk around, they'd hold their computer, you know, like, they're holding a book at their side, and they're just walking around with their laptop, and they'd be like, no, don't do that. I guess now it doesn't matter, because mostly it's SSD, but yeah, it'd be like, stop doing that.
Although, unless it's a 32-gig SSD, then throw that thing off a bridge.
It's out of space.
If you want to send us feedback, Twitter at DNCcast, Sean Washbot, and I'm Shrockwell. It's S-C-H... Rockwell.
And as always, everything we mentioned today, articles and stories, they'll be linked in the show notes at dnc.show. So head on over to dnc.show to read about all the, you know, people deleting their games in production and bricking people's PCs.
And if you haven't read the story about EVE Online, like the biggest battle that ever occurred in EVE Online, definitely check that out. One guy forgot to renew a lease on some planet or something, and it turned into this gigantic space battle that, you know, cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in quote-unquote real currency and lost, like, ships and stuff. Amazing.
I've not heard about this.
Oh, my God. I'll put a link in the show notes.
It's wild.
Which you will also be able to read on spectrum.chat, where we're hanging out and enabling browser push notifications so we can talk to you.
And as always, thanks to Spec for having us and putting us out in the world and continuing to support us, even with all the uncertainty in the world today. So shout out to Sarah and everyone at Spec.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
back to the blocks.
Back to the blocks.
They ain't gonna mine themselves.
Yeah. All right, I will talk to you later.
Have a good night. Sorry, this thing has its own Wikipedia article.
Which does?
The Bloodbath of B-R5RB, January 2014. Possibly the largest PvP battle in history.
That's funny.